So why don't we get started? Thank you all for being here. I'm John Romley, and I'm really pleased to have this opportunity to talk with you today about some research on hospital spending and inpatient mortality in California. This is joint work with Dana Goldman and Bob Fujena. And Ron tells me that the style here is people just speak up, speak their minds, and that's great. Please do that. So just by way of motivation, of course, health spending is a very significant policy concern in the U.S. More than $1 in $6 of gross domestic product goes to health care, and that share has been increasing inexorably as health care spending grows faster than the economy for decades now. The federal government's a major purchaser, spent $250 billion on Medicaid in 2009, another $500 billion on Medicare, and out of that total of about $2.5 trillion, almost a third of that was spent on hospitals, and we're not even counting physician billings within hospitals. We're just talking about payments to hospitals. So hospital spending's a pretty big deal. And for decades now, researchers at Dartmouth University have been documenting how care is delivered throughout the United States. And the basic finding is that there's just tremendous variation. So what we have here in this chart is total Medicare spending per capita within what are called hospital referral regions. And darker is higher. And so a classic or a famous, semi-famous comparison is between, say, Miami down here, pretty dark green, and Minneapolis up here, pretty light. So there's much higher spending in Miami, and the question is, what is that higher spending buying us, if anything? And there's some reason to worry that the answer is not much. So Elliot Fisher and his colleagues at Dartmouth, in fact, have analyzed Medicare spending and mortality, as well as a variety of other quality measures. And this particular paper looked at just a general population of Medicare patients, and then also folks hospitalized with heart attack, hip fracture, or colon cancer. And their analysis of mortality accounted for, as best they could, patient health, zip code, sociodemographics, and more. And the key takeaway is that in high-spending regions, heart attack and cancer patients were less likely, not more likely, to survive 5 years. And so, you know, that kind of a finding that higher spending is associated with lower quality really just has major implications. So it suggests that we might be able to reduce spending without hurting anyone. And wouldn't that be great if that were true? So here's a couple of people teasing out that implication. The authors of that study, for one, the former director, I should say former, oh, well, more or less does, the former director of OMB for President Obama, making a similar case. Now, both of them are qualified appropriately and all of that, but this is a pretty common view, and it's hard to overstate how influential it's been. Back during the healthcare reform debate, if you ever listened to This American Life, that show devoted for the first time two whole shows to a public policy issue. And one of those shows, the theme was more is less, so more spending gets you less. And the first act in that show was Dartmouth Atlas Shrugged. And it was, in fact, a discussion of this paper. So it's very much out there in the public bloodstream. So how could this be? I mean, from an economic point of view, I mean, there aren't many contexts where we might think that more is less. It seems kind of crazy. Healthcare is different, though, so let's think about it. So on this axis, we have health spending, sort of the input, and on the vertical axis, we have health, the output, and this is what economists call a production function. And here we have what's called flat of the curve, where as you use more inputs, you don't really get more outputs. So at the margin, you're getting very little for your dollars. And in principle, you could work your way up that production function to be on that flat of the curve. And in theory, you could even be out here where what you experience is iatrogenic harm, because you've received, people are receiving so much care that the last little bit of care they receive doesn't really do a whole lot for them. And yet every time you go to the hospital or what have you, there's some chance of something going wrong. And in fact, out here, spending more would lead to worse quality of care. From a more theoretical perspective, why might we think that this could happen? So, well, healthcare, again, it's not, it's a little bit odd, but healthcare is different. So the first thing to recognize is that patients demand health, right? That's what they care about. But they really don't know what that production function is. They don't know what the quality of their doctors is, often. They have imperfect information about the impact of healthcare on health, and so all they can do is consume healthcare and hope that it's going to lead to what it is that they really want, health. Now, doctors have financial incentives, arguably, to supply too much care, because payment has been tied, largely, to the delivery of care and not the achievement of health, right? And even leaving aside that sort of financial story, even doctors are imperfectly informed about what's going on, right? I mean, this is sort of what this seminar is about, comparative effectiveness and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And it's not easy for doctors even, because here you have customers, consumers, who are quite heterogeneous in their healthcare situation and their broader circumstances. And where the technology of medical care is rapidly evolving and hard to keep on top of. So for all these reasons, healthcare could be so different that we really might be out on that flat of the curve or even the downward turning portion. That said, you know, for many economists, this kind of story, taking it that far, is at least a little uncomfortable and raises questions about, is that really right? And in recent years, economists have been looking at the relationship between healthcare spending and health outcomes, largely in the context of hospitals. So just to give you a little bit of a flavor, here's a study that looks at folks who are just old enough for Medicare and just not old enough, right? So just above and below age 65. So what's really different about them is whether they have Medicare. And then looks at emergency admissions and finds that the folks who do have Medicare, just over 65, in fact have appreciably higher spending and lower mortality. So it's that gap around 65 that suggests that this kind of gives you a clean story for what's driving both spending and health outcomes. And similarly, a similar strategy has been used in the context of low birth weight. So looking at infants just above and below the low birth weight threshold for more or less intensive care, and similar results obtained. So we analyzed hospital spending and mortality using a different approach. So we continued this focus on hospitals, but we didn't want to take, we wanted to reach a different audience. And our emphasis in this paper is on quality measures, on good measurement as best as we can do it, rather than clever identification strategies that economists will often use. And the reason we were able to do this, in fact, is that the 2008 Dartmouth Atlas, for the first time, disaggregated total regional spending, which Fisher and his colleagues looked at, into hospital spending. So what they did was they took chronically ill Medicare beneficiaries and assigned them to the hospital their most frequent admission, and then broke out all their Medicare spending into site of care. So hospital spending, outpatient, SNF, and so on. So you have hospital spending for the people who were mainly treated at a particular hospital. That's the way to think about it. And they measure it over the last 2 years of life. That's their typical practice. And the argument is that end-of-life spending measures treatment intensity or style of practice rather than mortality risk or patient preferences. So we're not going to, you know, people can debate whether that's right, but we're just going to take that argument as given and see if what holds for total spending within regions also holds at the hospital level. Let me pause there. So we're sort of taking that Fisher study and drilling down into hospitals. That's the way to think about it. Okay, so we linked spending from the Dartmouth Atlas, hospital spending from the Dartmouth Atlas, to 208 hospitals in California that accounted for almost two-thirds of discharges statewide over the 10-year period that we analyzed. And we considered six admitting diagnoses that you can see right here. These represent, from our point of view, a pretty good range of conditions and acuity and all of that. And so for the analysis, we estimated a logistic model of patient-level mortality. And we included, of course, hospital spending in that model. We also include all the controls that Fisher had available, at least for certain of his cohorts. And then we added patient-level mortality risk from AHRQ's inpatient quality indicators. So these indicators were developed by the Evidence-Based Practice Center at Stanford and UCSF, they correspond to the conditions. So there's an indicator for each of the six conditions that we study, a mortality indicator. And one can use the underlying clinical models from those indicators to actually predict the risk or likelihood of mortality for specific patients and put that in the analysis, and that's what we did. So it's sort of risk adjustment plus, you might say, relative to some of the earlier work. And just to kind of give you a little bit of a flavor for that, so here is for congestive heart failure, the inpatient quality indicator. So we're talking about mortality rates, so the numerator is just going to be the number of deaths. The denominator is the number of discharges in the sample, in the selected sample, where that is based on age and having a principal diagnosis code of CHF. Here are the codes. Some cases are excluded. For example, if you don't know whether someone died or not, you're not going to be in the sample. If you transfer to a short-term hospital, they're going to exclude you. They're trying to get a good, clean measure of how hospitals are performing. And then here is the mortality risk model for this particular inpatient quality indicator. So the folks at AHRQ, they identify the CHF patients, and then they estimate on a national sample of patients this mortality model. And here are the parameters in the model. And then you can use that for just a set of discharges that you have ready to hand, like we did, to predict the risk of patient mortality, inpatient mortality. So you have gender, age interacted with gender, and then you have various APR DRGs, all patient refined DRGs, including both the overall APR DRG and then these risk of mortality subclasses. That's what this is, you know, minor, moderate, major, extreme. That's referring to further information within an APR DRG on how likely mortality is for that case.
This is coded by the physician who treated them right before they died, or who put in these codes?
This is designed to work with standard administrative discharge databases.
Got it.
So who enters that information? I honestly, in a
hospital. You know what I mean? Like if I'm a urologist, let's say, and I have a patient with prostate cancer who I've had for 20 years and he ends up dying of prostate cancer, he dies in the ICU and the intensivist codes this, they may code like pneumonia as the cause of death.
Right,
because that was the immediate cause.
So here, the admitting diagnosis for this IQI, the admitting diagnosis would have to be CHF. The cause, if there's another cause of death, that's not in a standard administrative discharge data set, so it's not going to be in there.
Got it.
you know, if they've done this well, it should deal with some of those issues, but it's for sure any risk adjustment model is limited and imperfect. So here are the patient samples that we analyzed, just to give you a little sense of that. So we have pretty good sample sizes. The smallest is about 100,000 patients for hip fracture, and we have about almost 350,000 patients for pneumonia. Inpatient mortality, and we're focusing on inpatient mortality because that's what you can measure in the discharge data, and that's how AHRQ set up these quality indicators. Inpatient mortality ranged from a low of just about 3% for hip fracture up to almost 12% for stroke. That's actual, not predicted. And then we have, you know, a Charlson DAO index of comorbid conditions, which Fisher had used. We have all the zip code demographics and elderly population disability characteristics that they used in their analysis. Right, so what we did was we took those 208 hospitals and we sorted them by hospital spending from the Dartmouth Atlas, and we put them into five groups, quintiles. And so quintile five here is going to be the highest spending hospitals relative to quintile one, the lowest spending hospitals. Dartmouth hospital spending is about 250%, two and a half times. Did I do that right? Two and a half times. Might be 350%. But what you see for across these six conditions is we move in the direction of higher spending. The sort of reference group here is low spending, quintile one. We see that the odds ratios tend to decrease. Not always, but relatively, you know, there's a fair degree of consistency. And so this is the odds ratio of risk-adjusted inpatient mortality. So where it's less than one, what that says is that relative to a patient at a lowest spending hospital, the risk is lower, right? So you can see that for yourself. That's a little bit hard to interpret exactly what that means in practical terms. So we did a thought experiment. We asked, what if we took all patients and put them in the lowest spending hospitals and then put them in the highest spending hospitals? How many lives or inpatient deaths could have been avoided? Okay, and so over the first half of our analysis period, that's what this is right here that you see. The numbers are pretty substantial. So for pneumonia, it's more than 6,000 lives. In sort of relative terms, these are substantial impacts. So for congestive heart failure, it's a slightly greater than 20% reduction in inpatient mortality and moving from the bottom to the top in terms of spending.
For those that's not familiar, what is a thought experiment? Like, how do you...
Right, Instata, which is the software analysis package that we use, we basically say, there are a couple ways, conceptually, what we do is we imagine that each person stays the same in terms of their age and their gender and, you know, where they live and what their neighbors are like in terms of... And all we do is we change the spending level, right? So we take the full sample, and we say everyone is now in quintile one, and then we predict mortality based on the analysis that we just ran. And then we say, okay, now let's put everyone in the fifth spending quintile. But everything else about them stays the same. And then we just take, we aggregate across the full sample. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you.
So are you going to go into what the spending translates into, what makes the hospital different, or all you do is look at spending in this whole presentation?
We focus on spending here because that's where it's a good point that you're raising is unpacking what is different about these hospitals. Our focus analytically is on spending because that's tied most directly to sort of the literature that we're trying to have something to say about. We do speculate a little bit about what might be going on, though. To be fair, we don't address it here. But if I can conjure up what my MD collaborator had to say about this issue, I mean, he referred to this Barnato paper in medical care last year that some of you may know, where she and her colleagues looked at life-sustaining treatments like intubation, tracheostomy, things like that. And what she finds is that that those life-sustaining treatments are in fact associated with lower, I think it's 90 and 180-day mortality. So, you know, in our can we translate that directly into what's going on at these hospitals? They're probably more proxies for what's kind of for treatment style, for more intensive treatment style that may be going on for the kinds of patients that we analyze. So, you know, perhaps for AMI, it's more frequent revascularization. Perhaps for GI hemorrhage, it's use of endoscopy. But we haven't addressed that in this study, and that is something that would be worth addressing.
Do you have any data on like mortality, say like 1 year after discharge? I think that would be a good way of addressing whether the mortality reduction is driven by use of life-sustaining treatments or versus being, you know, something else that's driving it.
Right. So that's a good question. I mean, it's certainly of interest to look at the longer term.
Right.
You know, one reason is that it would speak to this issue of whether you're just kind of getting people out the door alive and then they just die. I would also allow you to say something about what is the cost effectiveness of this spending. Because if you're just looking at a 7-day stay, you really want to know something about their longer term survival and judging how cost effective that spending is. Now, these AHRQ IQIs, again, they're designed for standard hospital discharge data sets, administrative data, not medical records, which we would love to have, not longer term, you know, so what we had to work with was inpatient mortality. We were worried that our results could be confounded, that maybe, I'm trying to remember the story, but maybe it's that the lower spending hospitals, or the high, so it could be that length of stay, for example, somehow, right? And we looked at what's going on, and what you find is that the higher spending hospitals actually have a longer length of stay, right? So that doesn't cut in the direction one might worry about. All of that said, you know, it is worth looking at longer-term outcomes. There's some literature, very recent literature, that in fact does that, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And we've also gotten our hands on, you need something more in terms of data. We've gotten our hands on now some Medicare data. So we can try to make some progress there. We're kind of thinking through what we can add to our understanding at this point, given what I'm going to be telling you in just a moment. There's someone over here with a question.
What was the cost of moving from the bottom quintile to the upper quintile?
I think, so it's a 2.5-fold difference.
Per admission?
No, so Dartmouth measures it as the last 2 years of life. They aggregate the hospital spending over the last 2 years of life. So you shouldn't think of it as a cost per admission. You should think of it as sort of an index of how, of sort of treatment style, of a more intensive treatment style. Okay, so you can't interpret the number. That's another reason that we couldn't, using this, really come up with a great cost effectiveness number. We actually looked at a more, so the Dartmouth spending measure is for the early 2000s. To make the work a little more current, we also looked more recently here in this study and computed our own measure. That was both condition specific, the Dartmouth measure is not condition specific, and per admission. Okay? And so we focus on decedents, as the Dartmouth people do, because they argue that's the way to do it. And basically, we find very similar results.
I don't know if I agree with them that that's the way to do it.
Right? Well, I mean, you know, we're not here, or I'm not here to say that's the perfect assumption. What we did was we wanted to take what they had done as given. Of course, they've been extremely influential, and ask, at least in this one specific context, hospital care, whether that broader pattern that has emerged in the literature and been widely documented holds up. And what we find is that, at least in our context, hospital care, it doesn't seem to hold up. We seem to find the opposite. So that was kind of what we were about. Now, this adds to a growing body of evidence in health services and the clinical literature. So first, I just want to acknowledge Michael Long and some of his other UCLA colleagues who did an early study on congestive heart failure costs and mortality, longer term, they were able to look at for six teaching hospitals in California. Barnado had this paper that I just mentioned that focuses on life-sustaining treatments and mortality rather than spending. But of course, spending and treatment, specific treatments are going to be related. Then pretty recently, these folks, they're all, these actually are related papers with related researchers, looked at Medicare, and they looked at longer-term mortality. They focused on surgery, and then for some reason picked four of the six conditions, I'm not quite sure why, that we looked at, and more or less found a similar result to what we found. And then just, this paper is just out, and I haven't read it yet, so I'm reluctant to comment on it, but it's definitely on point.
But those all show that the more you spend,
the more you do. I mean, this one isn't about spending, it's about treatment, but the more you do, the lower is risk-adjusted mortality. They use different methods for risk adjustment. All of these, except for, so this one I'm not sure about, but the others, aside from us, are able to look at longer-term mortality, and they do find effects at, you know, in the 60 to, or in, excuse me, in the, like, 30 to 180-day range. So you can see we weren't the only ones with this idea of using this new Dartmouth data to look at something, but that's the way it goes. So with any analysis like this, one might worry about, even with all the effort we put into risk adjustment, one might worry, well, there's unobserved mortality risk that's really driving this, that somehow the higher spending hospitals are attracting healthier patients and thereby appear to be achieving better outcomes, but really are not. And, you know, one can never knock that down totally, but we did look at measured risk and found that to be positively correlated with spending. So for this story to have bite, you would have to see the opposite relationship with respect to unmeasured mortality risk.
Question. So you compared the top and the bottom quintiles.
Right.
Wouldn't an argument to defend your case be if you had taken a linear regression across all of the data, and because you're most vulnerable to the top spending hospitals are the high spending hospitals.
Right.
Whereas if you include all the middle hospitals, you'd be solid ground.
Right. So the middle. So that would be like three is the middle quintile. So you would then be comparing three and one.
Well, you'd run a.
Right. So rather than doing quintiles, you could do a linear specification of spending, or something even more flexible, a quadratic specification of spending. So just put the squared term in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we did both of those things. And more. So when you do linear, a linear specification, you have on that spending variable, you have an odds ratio significantly below one in every case.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of holds up, however you do it.
Well, not for GI and hip. GI and hip, nothing's going on there.
Well, yeah, right. But so when we did the linear here, we did find odds ratio below one, which suggests that maybe these ones in the middle are a little better than the ones up top, or excuse me, at bottom, quintile one. But you're right, that it's in the fifth, we can't reject one. And in fact, we kind of turn up a little bit relative to the fourth. But this is more there's a sense in which this is more flexible and hard. I think you said this already, and harder on us than right, because the linear, you know, a linear doesn't pick this up, and we want to be as tough on ourselves as possible. And in fact, this is how some of the you know, the Fisher paper does it both ways like this too. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, right. So that's a fair point. In terms of the very highest spending hospitals, it's four of the six conditions for which the odds ratio is significantly below one, and not in the other two. Right. Another issue was missing data. don't know if people want to talk about this. I'm happy to or not. It's kind of a little bit in the weeds. It came up during review, and you know, I gave another talk where people were interested in that. I mean, should I get into that a little bit? Okay, okay. So in the California discharge data, they sometimes mask patient characteristics to ensure privacy, right? So if there's, you know, one person with one kind of diagnosis in a certain age bracket, in a certain quarter, at a certain hospital, they're going to start masking things until that person becomes sufficiently unidentifiable. There's an algorithm that they use. And what was relevant for predicting mortality based on the HRQ risk model was age, gender, and discharge quarter, because that defines the DRGs. And so just in that first half of the analysis, 6% of records lacked one of those variables that we needed. And so the statistical editor we worked with at Annals raised this concern and wanted us to address it. And so I dug into it. I mean, it wasn't an area of expertise for me. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily an area of expertise now, though I do know a little bit more about it. But, you know, there are solutions that people have kind of used for a long time, maybe less so today, not sure. But those solutions are not fail-safe, okay? So, in general. So unless the data are what's called missing completely at random, which means that whether an observation has some missing characteristics is completely statistically independent of mortality and its determinants. Unless that's true, you can't do something like a complete case analysis or imputation of the mean to missing variables and expect a totally unbiased result. Maybe it improves things, but it is not a fail-safe. So there's a weaker assumption that's out there sort of in the literature, and that's missing at random. So that's conditional on what you do observe for a particular observation. If missingness is random conditional on that, then there are some things you can do. Now, it does seem to be a weaker assumption, right, because you're conditioning on things. But I don't know, practically speaking, I don't have a good sense of just how much weaker it is. It may still be fairly strong. There's a special case of this, which is called monotone missingness, which means that, you know, if one variable is missing, it implies another variable is missing for a particular observation. And I think the reason that that's helpful is my intuition, my gut intuition is that, okay, so let's say X3 is missing and therefore X2 is, because we have monotone missingness. Well, we do observe X1. And that's going to tell us allow us essentially to predict X2. And then what we have to assume is that X3 is random, conditional on the observed X1 and our estimate of X2. So it allows you to condition on more, in some sense, and is arguably weaker in that sense. The reason this is relevant is that the masking algorithm in the discharge records is monotone like that. They go to one variable first and mask that, then they go to another variable until that person cannot be identified. Okay? So with that assumption, missing at random, you can do what's called Bayesian multiple imputation. And so the basic idea is let's complete the data set, the missing pieces. Let's put the missing pieces in using a statistical imputation procedure. So you draw missing values conditional on the observed variables based on the relationship when all the variables are observed for those observations. And then you iterate that sort of Monte Carlo procedure a bunch of times and hope for near convergent. Now with monotone, and that can take a while, a really long while, with monotone missingness you actually don't need that iteration because based on X1 you could impute X2, and then based on the imputed value of X2 you can impute X3. So you don't have to get multiple missing variables for the same observation to converge, to settle down to imputed values. So once you have that, you basically have multiple complete data sets, and you just combine the results across your analyses. You have to adjust your standard errors for the fact that you're doing that. We did that. And so we went ahead and created 10 imputed data sets on the 2.5 million patients we looked at to deal with this issue. I don't know that it would have been feasible if not for the monotone missingness. That was a lot of work. We had to do that, you know, within the 30 days allotted. And, you know, when someone asks for something, you just do it, right? Well, you know, as I read some more, I'm not actually sure it was necessary. Don't get me wrong, maybe it was, but I'm not quite sure it was necessary. But we did it. And here you can compare how that affected the results. The results in the paper are based on the imputation procedure. But here you have the imputed and the not imputed across the six conditions. This is the fifth quintile relative to the bottom, again, the odds ratio. And you can see it does, affect things, but I don't think I would call it dramatic, and it doesn't overturn sort of the basic result. Another concern one might have about our analysis is that spending what gets spent on patients in hospitals could be confounded with differences across hospitals in productivity or efficiency. And so we're not picking up the true effect of spending more. Right? So now let's think about two hospitals. Instead of having one production function, different hospitals have different production functions. Okay? There's a more productive or efficient hospital, meaning that for the same level of health spending, it achieves a better outcome. That's what we mean by more productive or efficient. Okay? And, you know, this is a hypothetical, but this is possible. Let's say these are the spending and health levels achieved by these two hospitals. And then you might just essentially draw the line, right? So that's actual health and health spending. You might just draw that line, sort of semi-naively, and say this is the true relationship between spending and health. So a little bit of spending gets you a lot of health, right? Spending looks great, looks really productive, looks very cost-effective in some sense, right? If you just did that. But really what's going on here is these hospitals are just different, and they're doing different things and achieving different outcomes. This would be the true relationship, much flatter relationship between spending and health, implying that a little more spending doesn't give you nearly as much improvement in health as you would conclude based on this kind of an assessment. Okay? So we were concerned about this, and, there are big productivity differences across producers and in healthcare. So autos, for example, hours per vehicle at North American plants owned by U.S. firms, all U.S. firms, you have that kind of a range in productivity, big differences. And you have to recognize that new technology doesn't spread immediately. So this is a great anecdote from Donald Berwick. So in 1601, a British captain set sail to India with three ships. And on two of the ships, I think it is, yeah, two of the ships, he gave his sailors lemon juice. And on the third ship, he did not. On the ship, the sailors who got lemon juice, none of them died of scurvy. The sailors who didn't get lemon juice, 40% of them died on the voyage. Okay? So this is kind of a breakthrough, right? In terms of improving health. But the British Navy didn't provide vitamin C as a standard to its sailors until almost 200 years later. And during the 18th century, the British Navy lost more sailors to scurvy than to battle, notwithstanding the fact that there was this productivity improvement to be had, this great productivity improvement to be had. So productivity spreads, or technology spreads slowly, can spread slowly. And this has been recognized in the medical context, that the gradual spread of medical knowledge can lead to local customs or practice patterns that vary by area. That's, in fact, one of the sort of leading accounts of the variation that we see in the Dartmouth Atlas. So this is something worth worrying about. And to deal with it, what we did was we included region-level fixed effects. So in California, as the Dartmouth Atlas defines it, there's something like 25 hospital regions. Los Angeles, and you can kind of guess. But what we did was we put in essentially a dummy variable in the analysis for each of those regions and redid the analysis. So that dummy variable for each region would soak up if hospitals are just more productive in a particular region. It could also soak up if people are sicker in a way that we didn't measure before, on average, in a region. And so here you can see what we found. On the left, we have the baseline result that we emphasized in the paper. Here we have the fixed effects result. And it does weaken some of the results. You know, the odds ratios, for example, for these first three conditions are moving up towards 1. But in general, we still, so for 3 of the 6 now, we find with the fixed effects that deal to some degree with this concern, we still have this strong, sizable negative relationship between spending and mortality. Does that kind of make any questions on that? There was, by the way, a lot, you know, those dummies do matter. I mean, they're very clear. Something is going on. These regions are different. So what does all this mean for healthcare reform? Of course, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act reduces Medicare and Medicaid spending by more than $400 billion over 10 years. And in terms of the Medicare fee-for-service payment updates, hospitals are going to get $100 billion less, a little more than that, over this 10-year period, right? So we're going to see reduced spending relative to what would have happened or was projected to have happened. So our analysis, if it's right, it suggests that that lower spending would increase inpatient mortality. As we've already sort of discussed, we haven't identified the mechanisms or pathways for how that would work or address the cost effectiveness of hospital spending. I mean, it may be great to not spend this money on elderly people, possibly. I mean, that's one view of the world, right? And it could be borne out if this spending is not very cost effective, and we just haven't addressed that here. But it does suggest that at least you can't reduce hospital spending without causing some harm. Now, the overall impact on hospital care is unclear because there's lots of other things going on in the Affordable Care Act, right? There are attempts to stimulate productivity improvements. There's all that funding, both in the Affordable Care Act and in the stimulus for comparative effectiveness research, right? So the answer would be, or the question is, would lower spending under the Affordable Care Act decrease inpatient survival? And if nothing else happened, our results seem to point in that direction. But something else could be going on. You could have a productivity improvement that shifts the production function this way. For the same level of hospital spending, you now get better survival. And that implies that even though hospital spending is going down, you don't necessarily get lower survival in total when you add it all together. And of course, the Affordable Care Act actually includes direct incentives for high quality care. So CMS put out its rule for value-based purchasing of acute services under Medicare, and they're going to be paying bonuses to people who do well on various quality metrics. And so, you know, that's another reason to think that the story is pretty complicated and interesting. So, maybe I'll pause there before. So where are we heading with all this? We basically applied this approach as sort of a replication of Fisher in the hospital context. We've now extended it to look at hospitals nationwide using the nationwide inpatient sample from the Healthcare Utilization Project. Dartmouth has put out some updated spending numbers that we use for that analysis, and we find basically similar results. That's under review. We'll see what happens. We've also asked, you know, most of this literature is almost exclusively focused on adults. And it's kind of interesting to ask what's going on with kids, right? So we're looking at, so AHRQ has a set of pediatric quality indicators in the hospital context, but for the pediatric population. And so there's a couple mortality ones. One of them is for pediatric heart surgery, and one of my collaborators on this is a great pediatric surgeon. So we're looking at that. We've used the kids inpatient database for that, and the result is kind of similar to what we're seeing that in the other work that mortality inpatient mortality, risk adjusted, is substantially lower in the highest spending hospitals. So we're drafting that, and hopefully it'll go out this month or next month. And, you know, one direction we'd like to head is to better understand why our findings seem to diverge from the Dartmouth evidence. Now, you know, it could just be, it's not clear that our findings are really different, right? The Dartmouth, like, so the Fisher paper looks at total spending. It looks at all spending on all kinds of care. Well, hospital care could be more or less efficacious than other kinds of care, right? So, in some, we don't really know if we're really different. It could just be we're focusing on a particularly effective kind of care. And so we want to dig into this and try to understand exactly what's going on. So in thinking about what they did relative to what we've done so far, I mean, there's differences in how the analysis is aggregated. So they looked at regions. We're looking at specific hospitals. So there's the geographic component. There's the type of care that I just mentioned. They look at all care. We're looking at hospital care. There's also the time frame, inpatient, the analysis window. There's inpatient versus long-term. Another possibility is risk adjustment. So we include everything they included, at least for the analyses based on administrative data that they did. But we also have this predicted mortality measure from the EHRQ IQIs, which just weren't available, I think, to their research team at that time. So maybe that's part of what's going on. Maybe there was unobserved risk where really sick people, in ways they couldn't observe, were ending up in were in higher spending regions and appeared to have worse outcomes. Did have worse outcomes and ended up being attributed to spending more. And finally, you know, maybe it's the time frame. I don't, you know, my instinct is that's probably the least compelling candidate, but you know, it is a difference, and we can try to look at it.
John, I have a question.
Sure.
I'm sorry to walk in late. You might have already answered this, but I guess this kind of gets to your issue of time in terms of inpatient versus long term.
Right.
I'm assuming that when you're talking about long term, you're talking about mortality outside of the hospital because your original study just focuses on inpatient,
right,
mortality, not outside.
Right.
The hospital. I'm just not sure with the data sets that you're looking at, if you're going to be able to sort of plug into, you know, those sort of, you know, to actually identify the longer term issues.
Right, so that's a good question. We've recently gotten our hands on and are beginning to work with the Medicare data. And so that really allows us to look at a pretty long...
Because some of the data sets are actually going to be linked to death outside of the hospital.
Right.
Medicare would have that linkage.
Right. So, yeah, that's exactly why we want to use... Well, one reason we want to use it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've got. You know, I'm happy to take any questions or hear your perspectives.
Well, are there data sets now that would allow you, not, you know, directly, but indirectly, to say what's the likely long-term outcomes for people in these situations who study just inpatient?
Oh, so can we kind of, is there some reasonable basis for kind of extrapolating?
To say that they're not just saving their lives when they die when they get out of the hospital.
Right, so aside from having direct evidence, is there some reason to believe that? That's a great question, and you know, I've been wondering about that too. I did see recently a citation to a paper that I think in the cardiac care context looks out beyond their analysis. So they come up with some sort of disease state model that allows them to project out past their direct analysis period. I think it's like a, you know, I can send you the citation. I don't remember it offhand, but that's a paper I want to look at to kind of, I think it might be fruitful for this purpose. And then that might allow you to say something, at least where you're measuring cost per admission rather than this over the last 2 years of life, that might allow you to begin to say something about the cost effectiveness of inpatient dollars. The tricky thing, though, is you want to account for spending downstream spending, too, like 6 months from now, when you, right? Because that's part of that ultimate survival profile that you do see. And so... you know, we need to think about that as well.
It would be challenging, but you could get death certificates.
I think, well, I wonder if that's what Medicare does. I'm not sure how they do it. But actually, now that you mention it, the OSHPT has a non-public data set that you have to get special permission for that links to vital records like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so I just haven't, actually we have, on another project I'm doing, we're trying to get some of this non-public data, but we haven't tried it in this context. And by the way, there is, for UCs, there's a special provision in the law that gets you preferential access to it. You still have to go through an, you know, a non-trivial application process and human subjects and all of that, but I think the bar is much lower in terms of getting that kind of data. And they, you know, they have all kinds of special data sets, and you can ask them to cut you special data sets. I think you have to pay for that a little more.
Carol, where did you take an issue with Fisher's methods? For those of us who aren't familiar, what do you see as a major concern there?
It just seems like the selection bias thing. I mean, this idea that just because you're looking at death and looking from death back towards life, that you've eliminated all selection bias is really not accurate. Because, you know, if you look at our population at UCLA, we get people who come off from all over, everywhere, from Las Vegas, Antelope Valley, everywhere, because they're fighting death tooth and nail, you know? I mean, they're doing everything they can because they're in denial that their illness is fatal, you know? And yes, we can make them live a week longer or whatever, but ultimately, you know. So I think that idea that you can make people comparable just because they all end up dead, we're all going to end up dead. It's just not.
So what would you do differently? How could you do years of life loss or something?
What would I do differently to make people comparable? To make hospitals
comparable? Instead of having this, 2 years to death.
No, I have to give them a good hour of thought, and then maybe I come up with something better. I don't know, does anybody else have a good idea?
So what exactly is your question, Lenore, in terms of the frame of analysis? I mean, I think that the problem with, if you really want to just look at people, you know, about their spending at the end of life, I mean, that's just one way to answer, but it's not really going to get you at the cost effectiveness or, you know, the cost and effect of actually spending and what are you actually getting out of it, because you are censoring a whole bunch of people who actually live and got that same kind of care. That's the big problem with that analysis. But, you know, it doesn't answer your question. It depends on what your question actually is. So I think that's, and so the problem is that, you know, how would you get access to that, you know, deeper, you know, additional information? We don't have great linkages. I mean, you could always try to get, you know, Social Security death index information or NDI information, but there are huge lags with that. So, you know, it means that you're always going to have the time frame reference that's going to be several years behind because of that lag, unless we have different data systems that allow us to link things a lot better. That may still be worthwhile.
Or somehow we can make it a priority worthwhile that this data is released more quickly. And maybe no one's looking hard enough.
Well, I think that for the National Death Index, they go through, because they're collecting it nationally, they're collecting it from different registries, it makes it a little bit harder for them to feel comfortable about releasing the information. Mm-hmm. So they've often delayed things even longer than their usual two-year timeline. I mean, there are ways to do it through the Social Security Death Index, but you have to have Social Security. And, you know, as John mentioned, I mean, there are ways to get it from OSHBID, but the main thing is that, you know, it's not easy to get. So in terms of making those data sets available, OSHBID, you know, requires that you have special data use agreements and you're only for this particular type of analysis. It's not going to open it up for other researchers unless you go back to OSHBID and say that we're going to specifically use it for this other use, which they haven't done. Even when David Carlisle was at OSHBID, nobody ever got that kind of access.
You came in a little bit late. You didn't see that you were featured in one of the early slides.
No, it's very tough.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.